morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the book they have written, are in the process of writing, or intend to write someday. My co-host and the producer of Right Here, Right Now is Andy Lowe. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Dr. Tim. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I already established you are not running in the peach tree tomorrow.
You know, we elected to go out of town, so I am not. I will still be running 6 miles tomorrow. It is my tempo training day, but I will not be doing it in Atlanta.
Oh, you do run. I do know that. You are an Ironman competitor, right?
That is correct.
When do you have one coming up?
I have a half iron at the end of this year, October 20th, and I'll do a full again next year in 2013.
That's right. You only do those every other year.
Well, I don't know. Last year was the first year, so we'll see how that goes down.
All right, good.
I promised the wife we'd take a year off. That's really what it boils down to.
Well, the good man, good husband, good all around. You know, a lot of people contemplate writing a memoir, leaving some kind of written record about their life experiences, and there are numerous ways to approach writing a memoir. And I hasten to add, there is no right way, only the way you use which makes sense. And today's guests have written their own memoir, but in different ways. And what we're going to talk about is how did each determine the approach to take for writing his individual memoir, and what were the challenges they encountered, what advice do they share, and does either of them anticipate expanding their books or writing a volume 2 or 3 or 4? You know, after a visit to his boyhood growing up communities of, I should have checked before we went live, but it's Baltzer, right?
Baltzer.
And Drew, Mississippi, William Graham realized that it would be impossible for his own adult children and certainly his grandchildren to visit and know the Mississippi Delta and its towns of his youth and formative years. So he set about to document the times, the places, people, and events that shaped his life and left an indelible mark on him as a person. And our other guest is former airline captain Brian Settles, who writes of his life as a biracial orphan who became a fighter pilot to overcome the demons of his childhood. He flew in nearly 200 combat missions. Actually, it was 199 and an almost, wasn't it?
Yes.
And he tells about that in his book. His book, No Reason for Dying, shares a ruthless, honest testimony of his wartime experience and the hard lessons he subsequently learned in search of himself as he sought a greater purpose in life. Well, regular listeners to Right Here, Right Now know that our usual format is to interview each guest individually, but prior to the show, I told Bill and Brian, that I would be sharing the conversation from the top, and they agreed. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Let me give a perspective to our listeners. What I like about Bill Graham's book, it was okay, a memoir. First, it's huge, over 300 pages, filled with information. What you have done is you've taken topics and just written little paragraphs, 2, 3, or 4, about topics, correct?
That's correct, Jim. Mostly it's chronological,
mm-hmm.
but not exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And just as I would think of things or my wife would remind me of something, she'd say, hey, you ought to write that down.
And so there it is.
That's what I did. Yeah.
Okay. And Brian, you literally wrote, we could say, an autobiography of your year in Vietnam.
Yes. Well, not only is it an autobiography, but I wanted to capture for readers the fact that there are many things that happened to us in childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them good, some of them not so good, but oftentimes it's the not so good things in our childhood that end up directing our lives. And as you alluded to in the introduction, my neediness about being biracial, growing up in an all-black neighborhood, mm-hmm. adopted in Indiana,
mm-hmm.
had given me a neediness that led me to fly airplanes to show that I was sufficient.
That's pretty severe. Oh, I mean, not many people would choose to fly airplanes, especially in Vietnam, to overcome inadequacy or neediness.
Well, that was part of the play on the title, No Reason for Dying.
Mm-hmm.
We have so many people in this country who are being run by their childhood experiences.
Oh, absolutely.
That are leading them down paths that don't reflect who they're really out to be.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do my motivational talks, I'm often sharing with young people and parents that proving that you're good enough out there, going down the wrong path in life, is no reason for dying.
Okay. Now, I want to simply pause and point out to my listeners that these are two main ways of going about it, as Bill has done, just finding people, places, things, events, and write about them, more or less in chronological order. And then, as Brian has done, taking a segment of his life and using it as a basis to reflect off of another part of his life. The reason I lift this up is I've got a lot of books on my shelf at home in my office on how to write a memoir or how to write your life story. And I'll tell you, every time I look at those, I become overwhelmed because of it. Just, you need to do this, and you need to do this, and you need to do this. No, you don't. You need to do what you think you need to do. Now, having had that opening salvo, so to speak, if either one of you wants to question the other as we go along or just comment, we're good with that. I want to go back to you, Bill. And how did you decide, and you said your wife helped you. I'm chuckling. I'm thinking, what would my wife have me write about? And I have no idea. How did you talk about going back to your hometowns, and realizing you needed to write?
Well, Tim, it goes back a few years. I took my son and I, who's a grown man now.
Mm-hmm.
We went back to the small community where I grew up, of Baltimore, Mississippi, prior to moving to the town of Drew. And I realized that there's basically nothing there anymore. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
The houses are gone. Practically all of the buildings have gone. It's just nothing like it was as I was growing up there. And I realized that, hey, if my children and grandchildren especially ever have any concept about what it was like growing up in that time, I have to tell them.
Yeah.
So I decided I better start writing, and so that's how it started.
How long did it take you to put this all together?
Oh, that's an embarrassing question, Tim. 10 years. But that's not continuous. I would write on it for a week. My wife mm-hmm. and I'd go off on vacation, and I'd spend a lot of time writing. Then I'd put it aside for a year.
But that's all right, and I'm glad you lifted that up. I'm glad I asked the question, because so many people think that you can have a book done real fast. I wrote a book last fall to see how fast I could do it, and I did it in 48 hours. I'll never do that again. But I want people to understand it can take some time. I'm working with a client right now from Alabama who grew up in Ohio, and he's now into year 3 of writing. And he mm-hmm. writes and sends it to me, and I critique it, and then we do some more.
Well, there are two very, very difficult parts of writing a mm-hmm. book of any kind, I think, but certainly a memoir. And that's, number one, is getting started.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to start. And the second one is ending it, is...
Boy, you got that nailed.
when and where do you stop? When do you stop editing and publish? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That was the hardest point for me.
Because you could always do it one more time.
Absolutely.
I think Andy has a question.
Yeah, I've got a question. Just listen to this, because I'm wondering, Brian, how long did it take you to write your book?
Well, I knew that at the time that I was flying the combat missions in Vietnam, having the most incredible experience of my life, that I had to write about it someday. I just did not expect life to get in the way and that story not be told for almost 35 years. But I did have the benefit of perspective, introspection, and the evolution of my philosophy to be able to tell a more powerful story, I believe, than what would have occurred had I told it fresh from Vietnam. Actually, I was working for my third airline after the collapse of Eastern and flying for a cargo airline. And I had a girlfriend who died of ovarian cancer at age 37. And I was in my 50s, and the idea hit me that if you claim that you're a writer, you need to be writing this story. And so while I was flying the Boeing 757 for ATA Airlines, headquartered in Indianapolis, I wrote this story between 1998 and 2003 while I was on layovers and sitting on reserve call-out with the airlines. I kiddingly tell audiences that 55-year-old pilots spend their layovers differently than 35-year-old pilots.
But you see, 5 years, Bill. He cut your time in half.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that's
well, that's why I was asking the question, because I was wondering, you know, it's interesting. You guys have such a contrast to some of it, but such parallels in others in your writing, the sense of urgency of the reason for getting your book out, both going back to some childhood things. I mean, I think it's a really interesting dynamic how both of them come at this angle.
Well, getting the story down in manuscript form is only the first part of the task. The re-editing and the rewriting is the labor of writing. Mm-hmm. And I had some fortune to have been a Spanish major and an English minor at Ball State University. Always had a love for language. I had I was a poet disguised as a pilot, and I was able to do the edits between 2003 and 2009 to finally get this story between the covers of a book and get it out there. And the response has been overwhelming because it's a raw, real deal story about how our childhood events can lead us down paths that we didn't expect, and it stands on the shoulders of the Red Tails, the Tuskegee Airmen, who, of course, made a major contribution to civil rights in this country.
Bill, you do not have a writing background.
No, I do not. I have an engineering background, and but I actually enjoy writing.
Mm-hmm.
I do write things, but mostly for myself, mm-hmm. or exclusively for myself. If I have some event, my sister died.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did quite a bit of writing about that, but not for anyone else to read.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have a technical background rather than a writing background or whatever.
Yeah, but see, I like to lift that up as well, because so many folks that I deal with think that if they didn't major in English or journalism or anything like that, they really can't. You can write. You can still write.
You can. I have essentially no background in writing other mm-hmm. than a technical report or something. But
that's writing. You just have to make it user friendly. That's I have two
that's
sons.
The hard part.
I have two sons that work as engineers, and when they get out of their engineering speak, they don't do bad mm-hmm. when they write. How did you pick so many things to write about?
Well, some people have asked me, you know, what is the theme or the premise of your book? You know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm thinking, well, it doesn't have one. If I thought about some experience, I wrote it down, and then I did some editing in and out, but that was basically the process, Tim.
Okay. What I liked about yours as I read it is it triggered, and even as you've talked about it now, is the thoughts it triggered within me. My hometown of Greenville, Pennsylvania, has gone on some hard times over the years, lost all of its major industries. Three things remain the same in my hometown: the Majestic Bar and its hot dogs, Paxton's Diner, and the News Depot. And when I was last home, I challenged the people to figure out why those three things haven't changed over the time. Because there's got to be some kind of business secret there or perspective that those three have withstood the time, and they continue to be there. And conversely, Brian, to bring you in on it, when you talk about your background and your childhood and all the battles, we all have those. You know, I was the youngest of three, and it was last week I went out and I helped my neighbor kid shoot baskets. He was practicing. I was grabbing the ball when it came through the hoop and sent it back to him. He said, "Did you play basketball?" I said, "No." I stayed as far away from sports as I could because my brother was all-state football, all-state baseball, and a state champion wrestler. No way was I going there. So we have these things. Mm-hmm. Let me just say, what do you want to say, Brian?
Well, that athletic reference that you mentioned, when I do my motivational speaking, I do share with audiences often how we oftentimes in life don't get the first dream.
Mm-hmm.
that we're carrying. And my obsession as a youth, proving my worth and sufficiency, was to be unstoppable in the basketball court and for it to take a half a dozen people to bring me down once I caught a pass. But it was not the Lord's intention for me to be a big-time college football or basketball player. And actually, I was already a pilot before I realized I wanted to be one. When the dream was shattered of sports, I fell into ROTC just to be on the drill team and had never thought about flying an airplane in my life. And all of a sudden on that drill team, half of those players wanted to be Air Force pilots. And I tell young people that you are who you run around with. And by running around with those drill team members who wanted to be Air Force pilots and needing something to replace the glory of sports, I latched on to aviation to be the next uniform-wearing activity.
In your book, you have a photograph, as I recall, of the orphanage in Nebraska. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do I remember?
Lincoln State Orphanage.
How did you get from Nebraska to Muncie, Indiana?
Well, the blessing of my life is that I spent 3 years in that Nebraska orphanage after being given away by my white mother, who had gotten pregnant at 16 by her African-American boyfriend. And I spent 3 years in the orphanage before my mother and father in Muncie were told by the welfare agency that there was a biracial child in a Lincoln, Nebraska orphanage that was available for adoption. They got on the train, came out, saw me pacing in my cell, fell in love with me, and signed the paperwork and took me back to Muncie, Indiana, where I had the unique experience of growing up the lightest thing in an all-black neighborhood, seeking acceptance and sufficiency with my neighborhood playmates.
Wow. That's quite the journey, isn't it? And that's a lot of what you draw on here. Let me scoot back over to you, Bill. When you say you went back to the Delta of Mississippi and saw how it had changed from your childhood, what particularly were you hoping your grandchildren would be able to learn from you or remember? What was not there for them to see that you felt was important?
I would say, Tim, primarily the culture. There was a culture there. You know, a lot of people lived in that area at that time. Now, very, very few people live there.
Okay.
And so the culture is completely gone. And so that's what I'd like for them to be able to see some of that.
When you were growing up, there would have been some severe racism.
There was, yes. I don't feel that I was, my immediate family ever participated in that at all. My dad, as I say in the book, he ran a little small store. And a grocery store, a little mom-and-pop type store. And he just didn't tolerate it.
Okay. And that works. Just as simple as that. How do your grandkids ask you about those things?
Not that much. I think they would if they knew a little more about it.
Sure.
And I think as they get a little older, they will.
My
youngest grandchild is 8 or 9. And so, you know, they're not really into that sort of thing yet. But I think they will eventually once they, you know, hopefully they'll read my book one day.
Well, that was going to be my have they attempted to read it or read snippets of it?
Some of them have. One granddaughter has pretty well read all of it. And she's very, she's quite a writer herself, by
the
way. And so she was very interested in it. I think just as a book, and so she has read it. And I think the others will eventually.
Did you have any family members who knew what you were about, worried about what you might say of them?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. And I think they had no reason to worry because it certainly was not a an expose or something like that. That was not my intent.
Well, I understand that. Reason I bring it up is when I wrote my book, Letters to My Sons, my sister was petrified what baby brother was going to say. You know, was this going to be payback? Took me the longest of time, honestly, to figure out why she was so nervous. And then it dawned upon me. And once I knew that, I said, you're just going to have to wait until the book comes out. I had my moments of payback. Brian, one of the things that you mentioned in the book is that you were adopted by this loving family, and then Dad left.
Yes, my adoptive father left home when I was 8 years old. I continued to have a relationship with him, but it was more like a peer relationship because he was an ex-jock, and our commonality was my obsession with sports myself. Strange, though, that these young people today who come up in homes that don't have fathers are critically in need of role models. And I tell audiences oftentimes in my talk that my father was not the best role model because he was a womanizer and he left home. And what I was left planted with was the notion that men aren't supposed to be faithful. And that's one of the messages that I wanted to get across to my male readers and female readers, too, is the hypocrisy that males engage in terms of fidelity. I was fortunate enough to be raised in the church, and I had a faith-based childhood experience, but got lost along the way. And in No Reason for Dying, I'm constantly in a struggle between ego and faithfulness to my newlywed bride while I was in combat. And as we can see from the media today, there are still too many men that have fallen from glory by being engaged in extramarital activities driven by ego and struggle with faithfulness. And so this is a testimonial that's a real deal in your face. Look at men's hypocrisy and encouraging them to look at themselves and to deal with striving to live the most purposeful life that they can.
Yeah,
that's free of sinfulness.
Well, how did you remember all of this stuff? Did you keep notes when you were in Vietnam? Did you have a journal?
That's a great question, because oftentimes readers are amazed at the definitive description of scenes and conversations. And I was a prolific writer of letters home from Vietnam. And when I arrived back from my combat tour, my wife presented me with a shoebox full of my letters from home. And years later, when I finally became engaged in the project, I was able to use the letters as the memory jog to tell the between-the-lines story that I was not I would not have been able to tell had I not had those letters.
Okay.
Yeah, and you mentioned writers finding your voice for how you tell your story.
Absolutely, that's critical.
I took a creative writing course in the village at the New School of Social Research, where James Lipton, I believe, does writer's studio, actor's studio.
Yeah.
And I had a professor there tell me that what I wanted to do was to act like I was sitting on the back porch telling my story to someone who I trusted and who was a friend, and that gave me my grounding.
That's a good image. You probably can relate to that, can't you, Bill?
Yes, absolutely. It was, I did not have any documents like that. I did have a few. We lived in Germany for 6 years, and when I was managing the Patriot program there for NATO. And we did, my wife in particular, wrote a number of newsletters she would send home. So I had those to refer to. But as far as the early years and my career, I just had to go by memory. And and that's difficult.
It can be challenging, it? You know, as you gentlemen, share your thoughts. I lived in Ghana from 1978 to 1981. And when I came home, I learned that virtually everybody I had sent a letter to had saved them. So now I have this huge box. And it's been over 30 years. And I keep that someday. That someday hasn't come yet. But I know, and listening to you, Brian, gives me motivation to maybe go pull that box out and dig into it. Well, let me throw a toss-up, and I want each of you to comment on this. What was the challenging part of writing your books? I don't care who goes first, but let's just out there. What was the challenging part?
Well, I would say just staying with it. And trying to remember things that happened. I had a bit of a problem in that almost everything I did in doing my career was classified work.
Oh, my.
And trying to, as I was trying to write about some of that and trying to, even now, I've been retired for a number of years, but even trying to make sure that I didn't, since I have been away from it, I don't remember exactly what's currently classified and what isn't. So I had to be very careful to not get into areas like that. That was a bit difficult.
That was not an answer I was anticipating, but that's unique. I like that. Yeah. I like that. Brian.
It's a matter of being able to do the due diligence work that's required to be a writer. I often was guided by the notion that artists paint, pilots fly airplanes, and writers write. And if you're presenting yourself to the world as being a writer, then what are you producing? Also guided by the fact that a girlfriend died at 37 while I was still driving a taxi cab for Buckhead Safety Cab after Eastern Airlines had shut down, and looking at my future, wondering when I was going to take a stand for finally doing my writing project. And I literally would drive around Buckhead in Atlanta, driving almost 300 miles a day, 6 days a week, with a tape recorder around my neck. And when I didn't have a fare in the back seat, telling my stories over the tape recorder. And then I had someone at Wayne State University in Detroit who was able to transcribe my audio tapes into a manuscript that then I could work with and edit. But Dr. Wayne Dyer said that you don't want to die with your song still in you.
That's very true.
And I'm the creative type. I love writing poetry. I tweet. I have a blog. And the thing is, I must continue writing and going toward the next project, which I wanted to talk about the lessons learned while driving a cab on the streets of Atlanta, fallen from the glory of being an airline pilot with Eastern Airlines.
That's a fall. And you beat me to my next question, which is, what's the next book? Bill, do you have a next one?
Well, I have thought about it some. Brian mentioned earlier that we are the people that we associate with. And that is true to a degree. I also have heard an expression a number of times that we are our stories. And so I'm considering writing just a book of family stories.
Oh, that would be great.
And so and the other thing I'm trying to do is to encourage my wife to write a memoir. And I'd be willing to even help her with that a little bit.
But she may not want your help. She's sitting in the studio here. That's why I said that, to give her support.
So my comment was primed for that purpose.
Because
she is here. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? We write one book. It takes us forever to get to that first book. And then it's, oh, boy, what can I write next? What can I write next?
Well, one of the things that I've been burdened with is this notion of the business of writing. To be a flaky poet pilot who has creatively done one project is great. But the challenge that I've had, though, is stepping up with the business end of writing, finding the agents, sending the query letters, and all of that due diligence that is what gets you really out there. I've done a number of motivational sessions and highly well-received, and the book has been very, very well-received. But have I had the initiative and the unstoppability in terms of the business side of it? I think that No Reason for Dying has a long way still to go because of the message that I convey to
And I think you're right, and that's a critical piece. A lot of people don't understand when they write that the writing is the, even as difficult as it may be, writing is the easy part. It's the marketing and getting it out there if you want to be financially successful, which doesn't happen to a whole lot of people.
Well, I want to back up on that because I would, from my perspective, I would almost disagree with the writing being the easy part. Bill and I were talking about this earlier, and Brian, you had a couple of insights that I thought were really interesting on the challenge question. Maybe you guys can elaborate here. You know, myself, I mentioned to Bill, I have trouble sometimes even putting a tweet out because I start thinking about wordsmithing. How's it going to sound? How are people going to respond to it? And this is 140 characters. We're not even talking about a whole book here. What advice would you give to people that have this song, this story, this thing inside of them that they need to get out to really get the pen moving and get this information flowing onto the paper?
Well, I think you just have to do it. You have to start writing. I don't tweet, and for that very reason, because I can't take it back and edit it, you know, and because no telling what I would say in that case. But I think just write it down. But for my case, I have to write in a manner that I can take a look at it, a second look at it, and so just do it. I don't know what else to say.
Well, just to encourage you, Bill, on the tweeting thing, it's not accurate to say that you can't take it back because you can delete a tweet if it's not exactly what you want to put out there. And I've deleted many a tweet that might have had a typo. There is an aspect to writing that you want to always achieve the maximum perfection that you can in what you put out there. And beyond that, the perfection, then, because sometimes people will get bogged down in the flaws in your writing and miss the message that you may have out there. So it's a double deal mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. have to be focused on. And then, of course, passion.
Sure.
Passion is a big part of being able to deliver some words that might have some profoundness to them.
Well, I loved your tape recorder idea. I mean, that kind of spoke to me because I was telling Bill, I can talk it out. Like if I get up and I'm doing a keynote speech or something, I can talk things out fine. It's only when I put it on paper and really start looking at it that I get over analytical about it.
Mm-hmm. What I like about what we're experiencing with the guests this morning is that, Brian, you really take writing seriously and use the word writer. And Bill, I'm not suggesting that you don't, but that wasn't really on your playlist growing up.
No, that's correct. I do like to write, but mm-hmm. as I said earlier, I like to write for myself.
Sure.
And so I have no aspirations of ever writing something for commercial purposes. Mm-hmm. It's not that the money wouldn't be great. It would be. But that's just not in my makeup.
Yeah. Well, what I like is I think each of you stands as an inspiration to virtually anybody who listens to the show right now or in the MP3 format later on, that you both have created significant books that pack meaning and impact. You came at it totally different, which made it amazing reading for me. And I'm flipping through Bill's book as I do that and seeing things pop up. And Brian, I think of one of the last things I read last night when the MPs came up to, where was it, in Thailand, and said, you really don't want to be here.
Right.
And how that was, and it was just prior to your 200th flight, and God, the universe, the world, really wasn't making it easy for you to make that flight, and you never did you?
Well, one of the things that the 30, 40 years of hindsight have given me is a very clear understanding of the blessing and the favor that the Lord showed me in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I survived situations that folks oftentimes could meet disaster in.
Mm-hmm.
And those MPs coming along that street, that dark street in Thailand, when I was out there unsupervised
mm-hmm.
in that strange neighborhood, possibly saved me from a disaster that night. And I had the arrogance for many, many years of thinking that I had survived those combat missions based on my skill and intelligence and brilliance as a pilot, not realizing that it was the Lord that gave me those mm-hmm. talents to be able to do that. And it was only through his mercy and grace that I was here to tell this story to hopefully motivate others
mm-hmm.
to look at their lives and to be unstoppable in telling their own stories.
There you go. When you look back on your life, Bill, as an engineer and Germany and defense programs and all of that, do you have an experience somewhat like what Brian is saying, like, wow, I did all that?
Well, yes, of course. Most of my career was in the missile flight test business.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be, I think, the most instantly gratifying experience and career that you can have.
Mm-hmm.
And you work for literally for weeks and months to pull off a particular test.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes off successfully. And you say, geez, I did a pretty good job.
That's got to feel good.
It does. It does, yeah.
And you were up in the air dropping some of those. More bombs than missiles, but still, you were relying upon the genius of engineers like Bill.
Absolutely. And I know one of the, no reflection, of course, on Bill and the work, great work that he did, but there were a number of fighter pilots who were flying the F-4 in Vietnam who one of their big criticisms was the inaccuracy of some of the technical flaws in the Sparrow missile, which was a radar-guided missile that had they had a higher efficiency rate on those missiles. There would have been a lot more MiGs shot down in Vietnam. But as I say in the story, though, is that many of our lives, as we look back on them, and my foreword kind of has that passage that there is a distant place that we can't believe we survived.
Yeah. Well, what triggers in my mind was when, was it, George H.W. Bush, Desert Storm, wasn't it? That first incursion into Kuwait and what have you. I was standing watching the news one night as we watched a missile come in and target, just, I mean, the building was gone, and I was, my wife was standing beside me, and she said, that's impressive, isn't it? And I said, yeah. And she said, that's what my company helps to produce. And I'm like, oh, man. that really got me. Andy.
I have a defining moment question I want to ask you guys before we wrap up today. And, Bill, for you, it'd be, was there a defining moment, or what was that defining moment when you really realized that, that this culture that you had grown up with was going to disappear and no longer be there? And then, Brian, for you, I'm wondering, what was the defining moment that you finally realized you were sufficient?
Well, I would say, as I mentioned earlier, when I went back to visit the place of my childhood with my son, that I realized that, hey, you know, it just doesn't exist anymore. And so that would be a defining moment. And that's one of the times that I, well, that is the time when I determined to write the book. And I think had I not done that, chances are I never would have written the book. So that was definitely a defining moment for me.
That's a great question about what did it finally take to be able to escape the burden of trying to achieve sufficiency. I think that when I look back at all of the blessings of my life, including driving the cab in Atlanta when Eastern shut down, dealing with the fall from glory, I realized that people stress themselves out in life because they think that they are their jobs. They think that they are their title. They think that they are the neighborhood that they live in. And having been a single parent father who lost his job with Eastern Airlines, was driving a cab, I was delivering a message to my sons of unstoppability and not giving up on losing our house. I think that having flown 20,000 hours of multi-engine jet time and looking back at the incredible accomplishment that with only shutting down one engine in 35 years of flying, that was a precautionary shutdown, and then escaping a bad conjugal situation in Florida, getting a teaching job at Dover, Delaware State in Dover, Delaware, finding the wonderful woman that I'm married to today, and looking back at what I've gone through, I realize, you know, that I've had an extraordinary life that I want to share with others, that they can also have an extraordinary life if they just approach their vicissitudes and upsets in life with an unstoppable will to prevail.
I like that. I like that. Well, one of the things we've made available of late is, excuse me, if our guests are amenable to it, we make available a copy of their book. And Brian, I didn't ask you about this, but Bill brought a copy in. If people listening, whether you're listening live right now and you have first crack at this, or listening later on an MP3, and don't think that if you're listening to the recording that you couldn't be first. If you send me an email at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com and say, I want that book, and I'll look at the time date that it comes in and determine who's first, we will have an autographed copy of the book, William L. Graham, It Was Okay, a memoir, and Brian, No Reason for Dying, A Reluctant Combat Pilot's Confession of Hypocrisy, Infidelity, and War. So I will check my Gmail account, see what's coming through.
Dr. Tim?
Yes. There it is.
May I also add that those who might not be fortunate enough to get a autographed copy through your invitation, my website where they can order signed copies of my book is www.CaptainBrianSettles.com or www.NoReasonForDying.com.
And you anticipated my next question because I was going to say, gentlemen, how can our listeners be in touch with you? So one more time, Brian.
No Reason for Dying. You can obtain a signed copy at www.CaptainBrianSettles.com or PayPal, www.NoReasonForDying.com.
And your last name is spelled Settles.
Like the airplane settles to the runway, hopefully smoothly.
There we go. And Bill, folks want to be in touch with you. What should they do?
Well, probably. I do not have a website set up. In fact, I have not even made copies of my book available for purchase yet.
But people might want to ask you questions on how you did that.
An email to WLGMVG@AOL.com, and I'll be glad to respond to any questions I may receive.
Okay, because I would encourage people not only to contact me, but to contact Bill and Brian if you've got questions about writing and what it's like to create a memoir. And indeed, the clock is on us, and I always welcome your comments and suggestions about content and our guests. If you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. And just send me an email at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. In fact, I should say that Bill is on today because his son-in-law was on back in May, Dr. Sheb True, who is the Associate Dean of Kennesaw State University Cole College of Business, and sitting in the studio with us this morning. He suggested that maybe his father-in-law ought to be on. He connected us, and here we are. Yeah. And what's sweet about it is that Bill and his wife live up in the far northeast corner of Tennessee, and you're in town visiting family.
That's correct.
So you can recommend a guest, and you can get them on, and we want people to know that. Well, Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services, and you can learn more about Right Choice Services at www.choiceservices.com. I hope you will join us next week and tell your friends about the show. Send them an email and encourage them to listen live, but you can always listen to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern Time at righterrightnow.businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business right here, right now.